Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Dave James. In a moment, I'll talk with a doctor at Ohio State about lung cancer. Then a segment with Governor Mike DeWine from his coronavirus update on Thursday, talking about the 10 counties in Ohio where the virus is most active and the 9 counties that are red on the coronavirus alert map, one of them being Franklin County. In about 20 minutes, courtesy of 10TV, Kevin Landers and Tracy Townsend have segments with Ohio State football coach Ryan Day talking about the postponement of the season and the impact on businesses. Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose discusses the upcoming election and thoughts from Congresswoman Joyce Beatty of Columbus about Kamala Harris being the first black woman to be a vice presidential candidate on a major party ticket. And I'll wrap up the hour talking to Sally Pipes, who heads the Pacific Research Institute. She recently had an op-ed published in the Cincinnati Enquirer concerning vaccination compliance in the U.S. First up on Columbus Perspective, I'm talking with Dr. David Carbone, who is a professor of internal medicine and director of the James Thoracic Center at Ohio State. He's also an oncologist specializing in lung cancer treatment. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Thanks for talking to us. You are talking about COVID-19 and your concerns as it relates to lung cancer.
Yes, it turns out that across the country, there has been a dramatic decrease in the diagnosis of lung cancer, 40 to 50% decrease, in fact, in the first few months of this year compared to last year. And while that sounds like it would be a good thing, I strongly suspect and virtually certain that it's due to delayed or missed diagnoses. People who are afraid to go to the doctor for symptoms or don't get their screening evaluation. And so what will happen is in the upcoming months, we may well diagnose cancer at a much later stage than we would have otherwise when it's much less curable.
And from what I hear, this is a type of cancer particularly that is dependent on early diagnosis.
That's absolutely true. It's recently been shown that using screening low-dose CT scans, you can reduce the death due to lung cancer by between 20 and 50% in high-risk individuals, which is dramatic. It's a greater risk reduction than you see for screening for breast cancer, for example. And lung cancer is the number one cause by far of cancer death in both men and women. And when it's caught in the early stages, it is much more curable. Most patients can be cured by surgery for stage one lung cancer. Yet the fact is that if you diagnose it when it's stage three or four, the cure rate is much, much lower. So I suspect these delayed diagnoses will result in a dramatically reduced survival for this disease.
And you mentioned that it might be out of fear of people going in for testing or diagnosis. So how do you get around that? Because obviously people are concerned these days.
Well, I think there's a valid concern about COVID and the safety of doing anything that involves contact with other people in these days. But what I tell my patients when they ask me these questions, I tell them that lung cancer is far more lethal than even COVID-19. And so they should definitely continue the medically indicated therapies as well as screening tests, even when COVID is prevalent. It is very true that the hospitals, and our hospital in specific, takes extreme measures to protect the staff and patients from exposure to the virus. And in fact, I'm not aware of a single outbreak of the virus due to a hospital-based exposure. We check patients' temperature coming in. We ask them about symptoms. We mandate masks for everyone in the hospital. And so I really do think it's very safe to have your symptoms worrisome for lung cancer evaluated.
Talking with Dr. David Carbone from Ohio State University, and you mentioned the scans that are available now, and I guess that's something that's fairly new or at least gaining in popularity, right?
It is quite new. There are now two very large randomized studies that show a dramatic decrease in lung cancer deaths and a shift from advanced stages to early stages when you do diagnose lung cancer, if you take a single low-dose screening CT once a year, if you're in a high-risk population defined as a smoker or ex-smoker over the age of 50. And it turns out that these scans, they don't involve any injections. They take just seconds to accomplish. And like I said, they reduce the risk of death from lung cancer by 20 to 50%. It turns out only about 2% of screen-eligible patients in this country actually get screened. And this compares to screening rates for example, breast cancer, which are usually 60 to 80%. So even without COVID, the uptake of lung cancer screening is dramatically less than other screening modalities, partly because it's new. And one of the specific issues that makes screening important for lung cancer is exactly the fact that the symptoms that you get with lung cancer are very vague and very nonspecific. In fact, small tumors in the lung usually have no symptoms whatsoever and can only be detected by screening CT. If you have a lump in your breast, you can feel it. If you have a melanoma on your skin, you can see it. But for lung cancer, you can't. And the most common presenting symptoms are actually symptoms of advanced disease where the cancer is spread to bones or brain or other places where it is much less curable than if it's caught in an early stage.
And I guess, unfortunately, if it's somebody who's a heavy smoker, they may be, you know, they've got the smoker's cough or a lot of congestion often anyway.
Yeah, so if someone has a cough, they can say, oh, I need to quit smoking, but it may actually be a symptom of lung cancer. So it's very difficult to say what symptoms are typical of lung cancer, but certainly anyone who's smoking should stop. Anyone who's a smoker should get a screening CT scan. But if you do have symptoms like a new pain in your chest or coughing up blood, those obviously need immediate evaluation regardless of COVID-19.
Dr. Carbone, anything else you'd like to add?
Only that screening is essential to detecting this disease early, and detecting it early really helps survival. And this is a disease that kills by far more men and women than any other type of cancer, both in the U.S. and worldwide. So it's important to pay attention to early detection and treatments for this disease, even in the presence of COVID-19.
Okay, and do you recommend any place to go online for more information?
There are now some really good websites that are sponsored by various foundations, and the ones I recommend are Longevity, L-U-N-G-E-V-I-T-Y, GoTo Foundation, it's GO2, and LCFA America, Lung Cancer Foundation of America. They all have lay-oriented, excellent, peer-reviewed information on what to do if you have a suspect of lung cancer, or if you have lung cancer, what the treatment options are.
Okay, Dr. David Carbone, he's director of the James Thoracic Center at Ohio State University Medical Center, also professor of internal medicine. Thanks so much for your time today.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for doing this.
Hello, I'm Todd Markowitz, Vice President and General Manager of Radio Ohio, which owns 97.1 The Fan. We're an equal opportunity employer dedicated to providing broad outreach efforts regarding job vacancies within our company. We seek the help of local organizations in referring qualified applicants. Organizations that wish to receive our vacancy information should send their request to the attention of Human Resources, Radio Ohio, 770 Twin Rivers Drive, Columbus, 43215. If you'd like to view our current job openings, please visit our website at 971thefan.com, and thanks for listening.
Pass it on.
Now's the time to stay apart. Social distancing. But I'm adding something else. Pull together. What's pulling together while we're staying apart? It's calling family to check in on them. It's waving to your neighbor. It's the things we should have been doing all along. And when this tragedy passes and we're able to come together, we'll be stronger than ever because we've already pulled together. Stay apart. pull together.
Pass it on.
From PassItOn.com.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Next on Columbus Perspective, we're going to rebroadcast just a short segment from Governor Mike DeWine's press conference on Thursday, his regular coronavirus update. This portion is where he talks about the top 10 counties in Ohio for coronavirus cases per 100,000 people, and then also talks about the 9 counties that are red on the coronavirus alert map, one of them being Franklin County. And he gives a snapshot of what the situation is in each county. This segment runs about 7 minutes. Here's Governor Mike DeWine.
These are our counties ranked by incidence of COVID in the last 14 days, and it's by 100,000. So this is the map we continue to show you. We showed you on Tuesday. This is updated a little bit, but pretty much the same. Let's go, Eric, to the top 10 of those counties. These counties are some of our smaller counties. Mercer County has actually come down a little bit, but still at a very, very high level. And then Door County is next, Lawrence County, Preble County. Preble is up there now. Meigs County, Sandusky, Shelby, Auglaize, Erie County, and then Perry County. So again, most of these are relatively small counties in our rural parts of the state. So what has happened is we've seen the urban areas that a bigger percentage of people are wearing masks for a longer period of time, and we're seeing those numbers come down. Unfortunately, we're seeing the numbers go up in our rural areas. So let's turn to the public health alert system. This is where we were last week. This is where we are today. And you'll see some changes and some things that we're very happy about and some things that we're not happy about. This week we have 9 red counties, the lowest number of red counties since we started the alert system 8 weeks ago. So that's good. 4 new counties have turned red since last week, and 7 though dropped off the red list. The 4 new counties that are red are Clark, Lorain, Preble, and Trumbull. They joined Claremont, Erie, Franklin, Lucas, and Mercer County. And we'll go through these. The 7 counties that dropped from red to orange, which is great, off the red list now, Brown County in Southern Ohio, Cuyahoga County, Fairfield County, Licking, Marion, Montgomery, and Muskingum. And as you know, Montgomery and Cuyahoga have been on that red list every single week. They now drop off, and so that is great. Some additional good news, 6 counties dropped from orange to yellow. They are Highland, Huron, Jefferson, Morgan, Richland, and Ross counties. Let's go back now and look at the red counties quickly, and these are in the order in which we have them based upon cases per 100,000 residents in the last 2 weeks. Mercer County stays red this week because of their high number of cases. They are 2.5 times what was considered by the CDC as a high incidence. They're starting to see a decrease in case numbers, which is good, but they still have the highest number of cases per capita in the state. Their hospitalizations have decreased, and they're continuing to monitor the small outbreaks, but spread throughout the county. Preble County is red for the first time. They meet the CDC's threshold for high incidence, and again, they're at 173, so they're way over that. They had 71 new cases during the past 2 weeks. That compares to a total of 269 for the whole pandemic, so they basically 25% of their cases have arisen in the last 2 weeks. Erie County. Erie meets 2 indicators, but they continue to meet the CDC's threshold for high incidence. They're at 129. They had 96 cases during the past 2 weeks. A large outbreak at a long-term care facility is responsible for a significant number of cases. However, there does continue to be community spread throughout the county. Franklin County. Franklin is edging down, and we hope next week that they're no longer red. But they're red because of they're at 109 cases per 100,000. Even though Franklin still meets the CDC threshold, their cases, as I said, have in fact been dropping. They've seen a small increase in emergency department visits from 21 visits a day on August 9th to 30 on August 16th. However, their outpatient visits have leveled off. Let me talk about Lucas County. Lucas continues red, but it is almost out of the red. Again, that is good. They have they have 102 cases per 100,000. They have gone from an average of 22 outpatient visits per day on August 11th to 29 on August 16th. They also meet the CDC threshold for high incidence. However, this number, as I said, has dropped. It was at 159. It's now 102 for the past 2 weeks. Clark County. Clark County is returning to red level this week because they meet four indicators and the CDC's threshold for high incidence. They are at 102. They've had 137 new cases during the past 2 weeks. From August 5th to August 17th, the number of outpatient visits for COVID have gone up almost four times, from 11 a day to 41 per day. Cases are linked to multiple small workplace outbreaks and a couple of long-term care facilities. The number of small outbreaks suggest that there is spread throughout the community. Lorain County is red for the first time this week. A particular note is their outpatient visits grew from an average of 20 a day on August 7th to almost 28 within a week. Their cases per day went from an average of 18 on August 4th to 24 on August 11th. They are seeing fewer workplace outbreaks, but they're continuing to see community spread. This spread is primarily we're seeing in social situations, family gatherings where people are unmasked and in close contact and basically let their guard down. Claremont County. Claremont County remains red this week. The county meets five indicators. We're continuing to keep an eye on numbers in Claremont County. Although there are limited small outbreaks, the majority of spread is in the community, and health officials told us they're seeing household transmissions. Trumbull County, unfortunately, is returning back to red this week. The county went from an average of 9 cases per day on August 7th to 13 cases per day on August 12th. They've had 115 cases during the past two weeks. They've had a couple of large outbreaks in long-term care facilities involving employees and residents. The majority of the spread is happening within households, according to local health department officials. So what we've seen, again, is the shift, a fundamental shift, from the, we're not seeing the increases now in the urban, it's going down primarily in urban, and we're seeing it going up in the rural.
That's Governor Mike DeWine from this past Thursday's coronavirus update.
In times of fear, World Vision has been there for the most vulnerable. For the last 70 years, we've stood with kids and families during some of the world's hardest times. Through natural disasters, war, and disease, delivering life-saving aid and support, helping rebuild lives, and empowering entire communities to lift themselves out of poverty. And we're doing the same today. Because rising to these challenges is in our DNA. And with every act of courage, faith, and love, at home and abroad, we do more than just stop the spread of fear. We replace it with hope. Learn more at worldvision.org.
This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan, courtesy of 10TV. Here's Kevin Landers and Tracy Townsend from the Sunday morning public affairs program Face the State on 10TV. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. Here's Kevin Landers.
I'm Kevin Landers, coming to you from the Ohio State House. The news that shocked the state, no Buckeye football until the spring of 2021. This was a decision made by a league-wide vote of Big Ten school presidents. In a statement, the conference said the decision was based on multiple factors and relied on recommendations from Big Ten medical officials. Last month, the Big Ten released a 10-game schedule for the football season. With so many ups and downs, Ohio State head coach Ryan Day says his team needs to know what's going on.
It's devastating. And, you know, there's this time of mourning, but we're focused on this, of getting this season in the spring or winter or however you call it going in January. So we have something to work towards. And it is going to be very, very difficult. You know, this whole year has been difficult. But, you know, we're going to stick together and work through it. And it's going to be difficult for a lot of people. There's no question. It hurts. You know, I have a range of emotions. Again, you know, just sad, angry, frustrated, all of the above. And I think our players do as well. But they're a mature group. I think you'd just really be impressed by the way that they've handled themselves. And, you know, they feel like they've had something taken away from them. But at the same time, we're really getting this thing, you know, focused on what's next. And that's why I really believe that we have to give these guys this plan moving forward.
Now, to give you an idea of how big this decision was, the Governor Mike DeWine, addressed it during his update. Governor Mike DeWine called the decision by the Big Ten to postpone the football season a disappointment. And by his comments, he clearly wanted Ohioans to know he had no part in it.
As a football fan, and we have a lot of them in Ohio, and a lot of Buckeye fans, that certainly is not good news. Ultimately, this is a decision that has to be made by the schools. They weigh many things, and I'm sure they start off with the safety of their players, but they weigh other factors as well. So I think it's a disappointment for Buckeye Nation. Probably more importantly, it's disappointment for the young men who play football.
The Big Ten isn't the only conference postponing the season. The Pac-12 is joining them also in that decision. So what do Ohio State fans do now? Many are frustrated with the decision, but they also understand it. We spoke with students. For some, it's a downer for their senior year. Despite that, fans seem to know the pandemic is more important than Saturday football games.
Most people, it's definitely going to be a downer, for sure. I was just thinking about that from a player's perspective, having to play the spring semester and then turn around and play fall again. I mean, that's going to be tough. That's a lot. That's a lot to do for the body. So, but I think they could do it if they really wanted to.
If you don't go to the games, perhaps you stopped in bars or restaurants. Reporter Stephanie Stanovich spoke to a bar owner about the impact of this decision.
I talked with the owner here at Nasty Sports Bar and Grill. He says the decision is really going to hurt his business and other businesses as well.
Part owner Frank Profeta says without football in the fall, his bar won't get half of the crowd it usually does on game days. He says it's not only about the money, but for many families, sports is a bonding experience. Profeta says he was a college athlete himself, so he understands what the athletes are going through and how much is at risk.
But the concern for the restaurant, I mean, it's just a big hit. You know, those are our biggest days. And not necessarily for sales for end of year, but those are a lot of the sales that we use to carry over in January and February, you know, is the whole season, you know. So that's it's really a revenue that we depend on.
Profeta says in order to bring in some income and keep the business going, he plans on holding charity fundraisers on Saturday. And he also wants to encourage people to continue doing carryout and going and visiting your favorite restaurants and bars. For now, reporting in Hilliard, Stephanie Stanovich, 10 TV News.
The state's largest school district, Columbus City Schools, put all extracurricular activities and sports on hold.
It's unfair in many ways, but it is necessary. But we still want them to remain positive and still have a good school experience. And hopefully we have some better conditions and then we can get back and doing some of the other things that they love, like extracurriculars and their sports.
The district is working closely with health officials and monitoring data to figure out when sports and band can start up again. They are specifically looking for a 4-week decline in positive COVID-19 cases in Franklin County. We are less than 3 months from the presidential election, and we know that all 88 counties will have one drop box per county But will that be enough? That will start September 1st. Secretary of State Frank LaRose says he supports adding more drop boxes, but says that must come from the legislature. He said he can't decide that on his own. LaRose said he asked for a legal opinion about doing it himself.
Candidly, I asked the Attorney General to weigh in on this because it was a question of law and whether the state law permitted that. What I decided to do rather than wait for continued legal analysis of that was to move forward and say we're not going to allow the addition of more drop boxes.
Democrats have argued that by not adding more drop boxes, it creates long lines and chaos at the polls. LaRose says he expects lawsuits to be filed about the issue. With so much misinformation surrounding this election, many Ohioans have every excuse to be skeptical about what they're getting in their mailbox, including unsolicited absentee ballots. We went to the Secretary of State to find out if they're legit and what you should do before you sign it. You're not alone if you received one of these in the mail. It's from a company called Center for Voter Information, and it looks like an authentic absentee ballot.
We have had a lot of people asking us, are these legitimate?
The fine print says CVI is a non-government, non-profit, 501c4 organization, and it's not affiliated with state or local election officials.
We know that political campaigns and political parties are going to be sending things like this out. We would ask them to coordinate with us and make sure that they have the right form that they're using.
The paperwork comes with a first-class prepaid postage, and the Secretary of State's office says the paperwork can be trusted.
We checked them. Those are legitimate absentee ballot request forms.
However, the state says before you fill it out, it's important to double-check with the Secretary of State's website to make sure.
You can go to voteohio.gov if you ever have any questions and compare the form on our website to the form that you're receiving in the mail.
10TV has learned that the Center for Voter Information is based in North Carolina and the founder is a registered Democrat, but says her organization is nonpartisan. We want to make sure that you don't have any questions about this year's election. I'll send it to 10TV's Tracy Townsend in the studio with more on that story.
A debate over mail-in ballots versus absentee ballots has been kind of confusing. Some politicians say absentee are clearly better. Some say mail-in are completely fine. And still others say there's no difference between the two. So we've had our Verify team looking into these claims to find out what's really going on. Here's Jason Puckett.
The president has come out against mail-in ballots, calling them a, quote, formula for rigging an election. But he's shown support for absentee ballots. So we wanted to verify. Are absentee ballots different than mail-in ballots? We checked with the National Conference of State Legislatures, the Electronic Registration Information Center, and multiple state boards of elections. Now, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, absentee ballots have to be requested. 29 states let any registered voter request one without a reason, but 16 states require you to have a specific reason why you can't cast your vote in person, like military service or business travel on election day. Then that request has to be approved in order for you to actually get your ballot. That leaves mail-in ballots, a small group of states that automatically send all registered voters a ballot, whether they request one or not. The NCSL calls these all mail voting states, and these are the processes that the Trump administration has been challenging, like in Nevada right now. The Trump campaign is suing the state after they passed a bill that would automatically send ballots for the November general election to all registered voters. Bottom line, claims that absentee ballots are different than mail-in ballots are true, but there's only one difference. And that's how you actually get the ballot in the first place. Regardless of what name you use, all ballots are treated the same once they're in the mail. With your Verify, I'm Jason Puckett.
Political history was made when Joe Biden named Kamala Harris as his running mate. Up next, we'll hear what Ohio's 3rd District Congressional Representative Joyce Beatty thinks of the pairing.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
Back to Kevin Landers, courtesy of 10TV.
Welcome back. It's official. Ohio House Democrats filed a protest against the passage of House Bill 6. That's the law at the center of the bribery scandal that led to the arrest of Larry Householder and then losing his position as Speaker of the House. The bill bailed out struggling nuclear power plants in our state. Lawmakers have also proposed a repeal of the bill. 4 others were charged in this scheme as well. All five are facing those federal racketeering charges related to a, quote, significant conspiracy case cited to House Bill 6.
The person replacing Householder after his removal as Speaker of the House is by no means a newcomer. Representative Robert Cupp from Lima, Ohio's District 4, was elected Speaker on July 30th, 2020. Cupp is serving his third term in the Ohio House of Representatives. He's been elected to office in all three branches of government and at both the local and state levels. In this new role, Cupp will take the lead, presiding over House session and providing direction of the legislative agenda.
Well, there's lots of things that need to be done right away.
Robert Bob Cupp, who, as House Speaker, now leads the chamber's agenda, its sessions, along with its members and staff. Cupp joins the state's list of more than 100 others who have filled the post. His name and face may be familiar to you. In addition to his work in the Ohio House representing District 4, he's been elected to office in all three branches of government and at both the state and local levels. Cupp is a graduate of Columbus Grove Local Schools, who earned political science and law degrees from Ohio Northern University. This is Cupp's third term in the Ohio House. He was Allen County Commissioner, a four-term state senator, where he served as the second highest leader, or president pro tempore, for two of those terms. Also, a Court of Appeals judge and a justice of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Robert Cupp also served as a city prosecutor and as chief legal counsel to former Ohio Auditor of State Dave Yost. The 68-year-old Cupp acknowledges there could be some cleanup to do in the fallout from the scandal involving his predecessor, Larry Householder, and what is described as a pay-to-play culture.
One of the things that I don't like to jump to conclusions, so there's a wide range of people to consult, which we will. We'll take steps that we believe are appropriate.
The new House Speaker says there are a number of legislative priorities, including a review of House Bill 6 and demonstrating to Ohioans those elected to represent them in this chamber do so diligently and with care.
We're going to operate above board. We're going to make sure that all our members understand or have an opportunity to inquire about legislation that comes and hopefully be able to set a good example that way.
Speaker Bob Cupp is 68 years old and married to Libby, who is a retired educator. They have two sons. Kevin?
Well, presidential history was made as presidential candidate Joe Biden picked his partner for the upcoming election.
The choice we make this November is going to decide the future of America for a very, very long time. And I had a great choice, great opportunities. I had a great choice, but I have no doubt that I picked the right person to join me as the next Vice President of the United States of America, and that's Senator Kamala Harris.
Senator Kamala Harris will join Joe Biden on the Democratic ticket this fall. This makes her the first female black vice presidential candidate and South Asian vice presidential candidate in U.S. history.
We don't have to accept the failed government of Donald Trump and Mike Pence. We have a chance to choose a better future for our country. So, Joe, Dr. Biden, thank you for the trust you've placed in me. Jill, I know you will be an incredible First Lady. And my husband, Doug, and I are so grateful to become a part of your extended family.
The phrase team of rivals took on a new historic meaning when Joe Biden selected Senator Kamala Harris of California as his vice presidential running mate. You'll recall Harris sharply criticized Biden in the Democratic primaries, but after ending her own presidential campaign, became a vocal Biden supporter and advocate of racial justice legislation after the killing of George Floyd in late May. Ohio's 3rd District Congressional Representative Joyce Beatty talked about the history-making moment as Senator Kamala Harris campaigns to become the first woman of color vice president.
It's a moment that we will reflect back on in history, and I'll be able to say I was there. So we're looking forward to working with her. She's smart, she's strong, and she's very strategic. So this is going to be a good match with Joe Biden. I think this is a part of a movement. I think this will even be greater because so many years, little girls, and especially Black girls, have been told that they couldn't be many of the things that we are today. You couldn't go to Congress. You couldn't be a U.S. senator. So you never really thought about being a vice president or a president. It tells me that we've gone from great agony to action. And that's the memory that we will have.
President Donald Trump reacted to Joe Biden's selection, saying he was shocked and called Harris nasty.
The horrible way she again treated Justice Kavanaugh, that was a horrible event. I thought it was terrible for her. I thought it was terrible for our nation. I thought she was the meanest, the most horrible, most disrespectful of anybody in the U.S. Senate.
The Verify team sticks to the facts when it comes to politics, looking into your questions about social media claims to find out if they're real. After Kamala Harris was selected as Joe Biden's running mate, lots of people celebrated her as the first woman of color to ever run for VP. But others were quick to say that they were getting it wrong. So let's verify. Is Kamala Harris the first woman of color to be selected as a VP candidate? Our sources are Amanda Meeker from the California Museum, Ravi Perry from Howard University, and Dr. Laura Brown from the George Washington University. Our experts tell us it all comes down to wording. Kamala Harris is the first woman of color to be selected as a VP candidate in a major party, but not the first overall. That honor goes to this woman, Charlotta Bass.
She stood for justice and equality.
We really admire Charlotta Bass.
We all stand on the shoulders of those who came before us.
Our experts say that Bass is an important figure, one of the first African-American women to be a newspaper publisher. In 1952, she was selected as a candidate for vice president in the Progressive Party, which was not one of the main parties.
One of her slogans when she ran for vice president was, you know, win or lose, we win by raising the issues.
Charlotta Bass certainly laid the seeds for Black women's active political engagement in American politics.
So we could verify as false. Kamala Harris is not the first woman of color to be selected as a VP candidate, but she is the first within a major party. With your Verify, this is Evan Kozloff.
If you received a COVID-19 test and were not happy with the results, the Ohio auditor wants to hear from you. Up next, we'll explain how you can report erroneous test results. When it comes to COVID-19 test results, it's important you get accurate information. Now the Ohio auditor wants to report the erroneous test results on a website he created.
There's really no standardized guidelines for reporting in COVID issues. And so I really wish there were some CDC or some national standard, but there doesn't seem to be. So we thought it was important to have standardized data reporting, standardized data methodologies, and frankly, a way for us to audit the accuracy of that information, particularly where that information is being used to make major national public policy. You have hospitals reporting differently than health departments that are reporting different than nursing homes. And standardizing this is kind of like putting together, in some cases, a Rubik's Cube to make sure that the information is consistent, it's accurate, and then it's populated on a state database used by policymakers. We're not second guessing any of the policy. We're not the ones who make the policy. That's for the legislature and the governor and the experts out there. What we want to do is make sure we have data that's reliable and data that's being used on that means what people say it means. If you hear a story about somebody who got an inaccurate test result or had inaccurate death data or just had an experience with the COVID testing system that doesn't make sense, go in and report that to us.
Every OSU student who lives on campus must sign an agreement for random COVID-19 testing. The university plans to use pool testing, so on any given weekday, a random sample of people will be selected. Groups of samples will be tested together. If that pool tests negative, we know everyone is safe. If that pool tests positive, the testing would go deeper, and individual samples would be tested to zero in on the positive case. But that extra step would only have to be taken for that particular pool. This will let the university test more people more quickly, along with that each day students, faculty, and staff will have to take their temperatures, answer some questions, and input it online.
It's important, and one of the things that we've done is try to impress on the entire community
how important it is that we follow the health and safety guidelines. If people follow them, wear their masks, physically distant, wash their hands, we're going to have a spectacular semester.
If students try to opt out of that mandatory testing, they could be asked to stay off campus and go to remote learning. Daycare has got the green light to open. 10 TV's Lacey Crisp talked to daycare workers about what you need to know to keep your kids safe.
He is a hands-on learner, and so he's going to need that hands-on. Ideally, I would like him to be in the classroom.
Lena Kreider's son will be a fourth grader at Hoffman Trails in Hilliard.
I have just prepared plan A, B, C, D, and just roll with what they offer and do the best we can.
She's posted to different parents groups on Facebook looking to see if other parents want to join in on a small learning pod.
Doing those small learning pods so they keep that social interaction and they're still getting an education. So it's a, I would call it a mini school. Or
for some, they won't be able to work from home and need full-time care for their young children.
We have a lot of kids that go to a lot of different elementary schools, kindergarten through fifth grade. We have two different school-age rooms.
For daycares like Brooks Edge that plan on going back up to their normal ratios, they'll effectively be taking place of schools.
We have a degreed teacher in both of those rooms, so they're going to be able to help more so, and we're going to also have an assistant teacher that's making themselves available.
But many daycare centers did not bring back all of their staff when they were allowed to reopen and are now looking to rehire qualified staff as quickly as possible.
We aren't fully staffed right now, so with bringing back all the kids that we would normally have, I'm a little nervous because we, you know, don't have all the staff that we did before.
And either way, daycare providers and parents are worried about what this school year will bring.
I think that the biggest way for us to get back to normal is for the kids to go back to school, to go back to daycares, and to just be precautious and do everything that they're telling us to do.
Number one, their health is important. However, they also need to get an education.
In Hilliard, Lacey Crisp, 10 TV News.
And thank you so much for joining us today. And remember, if it affects you, Ohio, and your family, we're here to make sure those accountable face the state.
Courtesy of 10 TV, that's again Kevin Landers and Tracy Townsend from the WBNS 10 TV Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
Text and work. Text and pretend to work. Text and act surprised when someone calls you out for not working.
Who, me?
Text and whatever, just don't text and drive. Visit stoptextsstoprex.org. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan. Hi, this is Dave James, and joining me on the phone from Pasadena, California, is Sally Pipes, who is the president and CEO, and she's also a Thomas W. Smith Fellow in Healthcare Policy at the Pacific Research Institute. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Thanks for talking to us. Tell us about the Institute. How did it start, and what is your mission?
The Pacific Research Institute was 41 years old this year. It was founded in San Francisco, California, by Sir Anthony Fisher, who'd found the famous Institute for Economic Affairs in London, England, in 1957. We believe in individual liberty, private property, and freedom for all Americans. The areas that we focus on are healthcare, which is my issue, education reform, environmental issues, and we have a Center for California Reform so that we can educate people in California about what it means when you have more and more government involvement in the economy, which is, of course, what is happening in California. And I've been president of PRI since 1991, October 1st, almost 29 years ago, and I came from Canada. I'm Canadian. I came from Canada where I'd worked as assistant director at the Fraser Institute, Canada's only free market institute.
Interesting. So as a think tank, would it be fair to say that your policy recommendations lean conservative?
Yes, they lean conservative, really free market. We believe in less government is the way for Americans to advance and to make our economy stronger and better.
You came across our attention from an op-ed that appeared recently in the Cincinnati Inquirer.
Yes. They published my op-ed recently on COVID-19 makes routine vaccinations more important. And, of course, many people, for a variety of reasons, have been not getting vaccinations, in particular for children, which is very, very important to have children vaccinated against some of the diseases that we have actually, you know, wiped out. But now it's, things are changing in this environment that we're in.
This has become a real debate, a real hot button issue, even you know, with friends on Facebook when it comes to vaccinations.
Well, yes, and you know, this all started, I think it was back in the early 2000s, when a number of actors and actresses, such as Jenny McCarthy, started talking about why that she felt that a vaccination caused her son to develop autism. Holly Pete Robinson, whose husband was a quarterback for the Detroit Lions, she also said that her child developed autism because of a vaccination. And so this has become a big issue, particularly in the last year. The anti-vaxxers have become very, very popular, and there is no scientific evidence that vaccines are causing autism or any of the other illnesses that these movie stars are saying. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have shown that there is no evidence of this. But it's interesting how the American public is willing to buy into advice that movie stars are giving them, and they are not people who have a medical background or a background in science. So it's really very, disconcerting to me because, you know, we're seeing diseases that have been eradicated in America and around the world, measles, mumps, polio, smallpox, because of vaccines, and we want to keep the market open for this. And yet, we're seeing, you know, people that are trying to convince the American public that they shouldn't get vaccinations for their children. Another thing is, too, that, you know, with the COVID-19, some people, of course, have been afraid to go to the doctor's office because they think they might pick up the COVID there. And a number of people also have found that their doctor's office, particularly if it's a single or a small group practice, that the doctors and pediatricians have, you know, are only working part-time. But vaccines are safe and effective. And as I say, we've eradicated many diseases. And if people buy into the anti-vaxxer movement and don't get their children vaccinated, we can see whooping cough, mumps, measles, these things that, as I mentioned, we've eradicated coming back. And that is just a terrible, terrible outcome.
I like to check out, you know, MSNBC, CNN, and Fox, and also listen to conservative talk radio on occasion to just kind of get a broad spectrum. And there is also mistrust about vaccines within the conservative world. I heard talk show host Dennis Prager yesterday, a well-known conservative, say that he has no plans of getting a vaccine for coronavirus when it comes out.
Right. And I've been on Dennis Prager's show many times, and he is really a terrific host. But it is true that a number of conservatives have said, not just conservatives, but many adults have said they're not going to get the vaccine. They're afraid to get it. Well, of course, it hasn't been approved. We don't have an approved vaccine that is so far that has received FDA approval by the Food and Drug Administration. But there are a number of drugs that are showing great promise in the clinical trials. And so Pfizer, you know, has a vaccine. Johnson & Johnson, AstraZeneca is working with the Oxford University in England. Moderna has got some very good results. So the vaccine hasn't been approved by the FDA yet, but I think by the end of the year or early next year, we will have an approved vaccine. The question is, you know, when we don't know the answer to this, if you get the vaccine, how long will it last? Will it last? Some people say it'll only last for 3 months. Some people say it'll last for a year. But I think, and I hate going to the doctor, I hate needles and all of that, but I think with what we've seen with this pandemic and how it has affected so many people in our country and around the world, that it is important when we do get a vaccine that is safe and effective for COVID-19 that people you know, take advantage of it. And as I say, as you mentioned, a number of Americans, conservatives, say they won't get it. The same is true in the UK. A number, you know, they're saying, showing 50% of people polled said they would not get the vaccine. Well, I think if you're in particular, if you're in one of the vulnerable groups, I mean, as we know, 85% of the deaths from COVID have been people over the age of 80, and people that are 65 and over are more susceptible to it. So if you're in that vulnerable position, if you're in a nursing home, for example, where a lot of the deaths have taken place, it is important if you're concerned about your life and your life expectancy.
Talking with Sally C. Pipes, she's the president and CEO of Pacific Research Institute. Even the flu vaccine, I mean, less than 50% of adults get a flu vaccine, from what I understand.
Yes, that's correct. And we think that, you know, based on what we've seen from a number of people, whether it's Dr. Fauci, who I think is just like Dr. Doom and Gloom, but, you know, Dr. Fauci, Scott Gottlieb, former head of the FDA, they're saying that there could be a second wave of the COVID this fall. There could be a third wave. And so we do, you know, we do need to be prepared. And if you can combine, if the normal fall, winter flu hits along with the COVID, this is going to be you know, a tremendous hit on people and their health. So, I mean, I think it is very important. And as I say, particularly for older people, my mom, I grew up in Canada. My mom never had a vaccination for the flu, and all of her friends did. And she used to say, and she lived to age 97, but she used to say, well, all my friends who had the vaccine, they all seemed to get the flu, and my mom never got the flu. But that could be because she was extremely strong or you know, wasn't near people that had the flu. But to my mind, for older people in particular, it's so important, because when these diseases, whether it's the flu or COVID, hits your lungs and you have to, and you know, it affects your breathing. Some people have to go on ventilators in ICUs, and you know, many people don't recover from being on a ventilator. So I think people need to look at these facts and not say we're not going to take a vaccine because we believe that Jenny McCarthy or, you know, Holly Robinson Pete are, you know, people, you know, to be believed. You need to look at what are the results from the Food and Drug Administration, from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. All of these things, you have to look at what the experts have to say, and not people who are not trained in issues, but they act like they are experts when they're not.
Well, the flu vaccine has been hyped for many years, but a few years ago, their stories started coming out, and then the CDC started addressing the issue that it's not 100% effective. And it seems like for a time, a lot of people kind of understood that it was. You know, there are some years when it's only like 30% based on which strain is hitting and whatever other factors there are. But it doesn't seem like that helped any with confidence people have with vaccines.
Well, I think that, you know, when they develop the flu vaccine, and, you know, these are very costly things to develop. You know, there's a lot of testing that goes on. There's delays because of, you know, getting approval by the FDA. But I think that, you know, that a lot of people, you know, have, you know, will read that, well, that I had the vaccine, but it didn't work. Well, the problem is that every vaccine every year, every flu every year is often different. And so, you know, these things mutate. And so it's very hard to be, you know, to have, you know, the most up-to-date vaccine. But they are doing the very best that they can. And I think it's important, as I say, for people to get the flu vaccine and to get the COVID vaccine when it does become available, and when we know, you know, more about how long it'll last and stuff. I mean, this, you know, if you look at all the people that are, you know, hitting on the Democratic convention, all the speakers who are saying the COVID crisis pandemic is because of Donald Trump. Well, you know, President Trump signed an executive order in September of 2019, which allowed private-public partnerships, which provided government funding to pharmaceutical companies to help develop the vaccines and the antivirals. And he also, President Trump, was the person who, you know, stopped travel to and from China early on, even though, you know, Dr. Fauci said it wasn't necessary. So I think, you know, there's a lot of politics in the issue of vaccines. But I do believe that they are important, and that people should take advantage of them if they can, and they don't have a religious reason for not getting a vaccine.
Talking with Sally C. Pipes, president, CEO of the Pacific Research Institute based in San Francisco. The whole vaccine world might be on trial with this coronavirus vaccine if and when it does come out, because if it bombs, there might need to be some real damage control coming out of that.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, the good news is that we live in America, and America is where all of the research and development and innovation takes place, whether it's in vaccines, whether it's in drugs for cancer, Alzheimer's, all of the great R&D in the pharmaceutical field is done in America. Companies from European companies such as Roche, Sanofi in France, GlaxoSmithKline in the UK. None of these countries are doing the R&D that takes place in this country because these countries have price controls on their drugs, and therefore, you know, they do the R&D in America because it costs $2.6 billion approximately from an idea to get a drug or a vaccine through the process, and only 12% get through the trial process. So it's very expensive, and if your country has price controls like Canada, where I'm from, there's no R&D going on. So we want to keep the pipeline open for the latest drugs and vaccines, and I think, you know, this is a very important part of the whole public policy issue, and it's a very important part.
Talking with Sally C. Pipes, she's the president and CEO of Pacific Research Institute. She's also a Thomas W. Smith Fellow in healthcare policy at the Institute. You mentioned that you're concerned about future, compliance with people getting vaccines and kids in school, et cetera. Do you see that becoming even more contentious with, because now we've got even school districts that have been fighting about, whether kids should be in or out.
Right. I mean, this is a huge issue. I mean, my husband is a professor of government and political science at Claremont McKenna College, and they were originally going to open half and half. But a few weeks ago, as the COVID cases in California increased, they decided all teaching for the fall semester will be online, virtual. And many USC, UCLA, all of these colleges are doing the same. And the schools, you know, Governor Newsom in California said the school, you know, can open the K-12 schools. But, you know, the teachers union is very strong and is very anti-opening. I'm very worried about how this is all going to end. Not all families, you know, can provide the very best in virtual care. They don't have the right computers, the right systems. Parents have to go to work. But I'm hoping, you know, you're looking at Hillsdale College in Michigan, Purdue University in Indiana, under former Mitch Daniels, former governor of Indiana, head of Purdue. These universities are opening, and we're going to see, you know, how it goes. But I think, you know, students need to learn in the classroom. They can have supplemental teaching, you know, at home through various programs. But we need to get the economy back on track. The economy is in a terrible place because people are afraid to go out. They're afraid to go to work. And we need to end these lockdowns and get America back on track. And the vaccine, you know, which, you know, as I mentioned, which, you know, will probably be available later this year or beginning of next year, is an important part. But people, as long as they practice social distancing and they wear their masks when they're out and about, this will go a long way to allowing people to prevent people from getting the COVID. The problem is young people, you know, they think they're invincible and they want to go to parties and go to the beach and these things and not wear masks or socially distance. But, you know, under this pandemic, these are things that are necessary.
It's going to be interesting, though, because when there is a vaccine, what if businesses say, employees, you have to get a vaccine if you want to come back to work? Or if school districts say students must be vaccinated or they cannot be in classroom? You know, when less than 50% of the American people right now say that they would get a vaccine.
Right. Well, it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, will there be legal cases if schools and things and employers say their employees have to get the vaccine? I mean, that's sort of not the American way. One would hope that people that, you know, are smart enough to realize that if that vaccine is available and it's effective, that it's in their interest to get it. Young people are, of course, much less likely to get the coronavirus. And if they do, they might not even know they have it. Or if they do have symptoms, they get over it pretty quickly. So, these are big questions that we don't know the answers to just yet. But in the meantime, people are working very hard to get a vaccine that is safe and effective. And in America, many, many companies are working on this here, and it's not happening in other countries, as I mentioned, that have price controls on their drugs.
Sally Pipes, again, President, CEO, Pacific Research Institute. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, I want to thank you for the interview, and I hope people will purchase my book, False Premise, False Promise, The Disastrous Reality of Medicare for All, Encounter Book, and available on Amazon.
Great. Thanks so much for your time today. Sure appreciate it.
Okay, thanks.
This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS AM, that's 1460 ESPN Columbus, and Sunday morning at 7 on WBNS FM, Sports Radio 97.1 The Fan. Join us again next Sunday for Columbus Perspective.